And reading down through the end of that chapter, the 48th verse, what I'm going to read is not simply the triumphal entry, but also what takes place after that. And the kind of different emotions that Jesus displays on his way to the cross as they are embodied in this text. It's not simply about Palm Sunday. It's not simply about celebration, but it is also the other aspects of Jesus' emotional and spiritual state as he begins to look and see more clearly Golgotha and the cross which awaits him. Let me say that Jesus will, in our text, celebrate, and he'll celebrate on a colt. Now, some kings did come on a colt, signifying their humility, although they weren't all that humble. I'm thinking of David's son Solomon, who began pretty good, but then he didn't do as well as he might have done, because I think humility escaped him. Nevertheless, Jesus comes on a donkey, a simple animal, and an animal often which was not looked upon as having any use whatsoever. The crowds will proclaim Jesus as the Messiah, and they'll talk about peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And we know that the Gospel of Luke begins with the angelic voices saying peace in heaven because of Jesus' birth. We'll also see something that's unique to Luke, and that is Jesus will weep over the city after his triumphal entry. And what Jesus is weeping about is what historically will come to pass once Jesus has been crucified, resurrected, and ascends to heaven, because in AD 70, and let's think that Jesus died between AD 30 and 33, but in AD 70, actually in AD 66, the Jews revolt against Rome. And it is a terrible rebellion. And Rome, under Vespasian and later Titus, comes down, sweeps through Galilee, destroying everything. It's like Sherman's march to the sea. And they finally, in August of AD 70, the Romans surround Jerusalem and they level it. They destroy most of the inhabitants, and they go into the Holy of Holies in the temple, and they take all of the gold, and they ship it off to Rome. If you go to Rome in the Roman Forum today, you can see Titus's arch, which shows Jewish slaves kind of carrying this great golden arch, the golden candelabra, which was sacred to the Jews. We might also understand, too, that when people laid leafy branches down in front of Jesus, that was a sign that they were acknowledging him as the Messiah. The Gospel of John makes this really clear when it talks about palms that were laid at Jesus' feet, at the donkey's feet. Because we know that in AD 66, when the Jews revolted against Rome, which Jesus predicts in our passage this morning, they minted their own coins, not with the Emperor Caesar on them, which of course was a no-no if you believe in a God who hates graven images on coins or anything else, but they mint coins with palm leaves, which represented the Messiah, represented freedom, represented rebellion and hope. But we see Jesus as a different sort of Messiah. And what kind of Messiah is he? And how does Jesus as Messiah help us to understand our own humanity and who we are in God's light? Hear now God's reading to us. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. And as he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' tell him, 'The Lord has need of it.'" Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as Jesus had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, "Why are you untying our colt?" And they replied, "The Lord needs it." Okay. They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. And as Jesus went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. And when Jesus came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples. They're too excited. They're too happy about life." That's my addition. "Now I tell you," Jesus replied, "if they kept quiet, the stones will cry out." And as Jesus approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what and who would bring you peace. But now I am hidden from your eyes. It is hidden from your eyes. But the days will come," AD 70, "when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side." The Romans surrounding Jerusalem under Titus in AD 70, August of AD 70. Jesus goes on and says, "They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize this day, the time of God's coming to you." Then Jesus entered the temple area and began to drive out those who were selling. "It is written," Jesus said to them, "my house will be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." Every day Jesus was teaching at the temple. But the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him. Yet they could not find any way to do it, because all the people hung on Jesus' words. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. This morning I want to move from celebration, which is the primary focus and the leitmotif of this chapter, celebration of Jesus coming down that half mile from the Mount of Olives and entering the east gate into Jerusalem, all the while being praised, all the while having people more excited than they've ever been in their lives, and celebrating life. And Jesus celebrated life. We have to remember that. Algernon Swinburne, who was a poet writing in the 19th century, and kind of looking at some of the other biographies, so to speak, of Jesus that were written at that time, Swinburne can say, "Oh, thou pale Galilean, the world has grown cold with your breath." Well, that's not the picture I see of Jesus. Earlier on in Matthew 9:6, the disciples of John the Baptist, and we remember that John wore a hair shirt and he flagellated himself and he only ate raw milk and whatever, you know. He was the best customer at the health food store. His disciples and the Pharisees, and they were no friends of each other, kind of united, and they say, you know, "John the Baptist fasts and we fast because we're good Pharisees, good Jews. How come your Messiah doesn't fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Well, you know, when the bridegroom is in your midst, it's not time for fasting. It's rather time for celebrating. When the bridegroom is among you, that's a time to kind of bring out the best wine," as Jesus does in his first miracle in John chapter 2, the wedding at Cana, "and to celebrate. When Jesus is among us," if Jesus truly is the son of David, as we are told in the New Testament, well, we know that David in 1 Samuel gets so excited in the presence of God, in the presence of the Ark of the Covenant, that David does a dervish dance in Jerusalem. It is a dance which is so exciting. It's a dance which I think moved far beyond the constraints of American Bandstand. How many of you remember that? Oh, it was much more dervish-like than that. You know, that sort of dance was almost scandalous. In fact, one of his wives, who was Saul's daughter, was scandalized by this because David got so excited that he threw off his tunic and he was dancing in his loincloth, I guess. And that wasn't a good idea. We don't want to see Prince Charles or Queen Elizabeth dancing in their loincloth, certainly. So this was a dance of the dervish in celebration. If Jesus was like King David, then Jesus celebrated his life. And that's, you know, in many ways, what we're called to do. We are called to be a people of celebration. But the kicker is, we are called to celebrate life in the midst of death. We are called to celebrate and dance and kick up our heels and sing Auld Lang Syne, even like Jesus, when a cross awaits us, even like Jesus, when the crowd will turn on us in less than a week, even like Jesus, when he won't be the center of attention, well, he will in a way, but the only parade he'll have in less than a week is the parade he has when he carries that crossbeam to Golgotha. We are called to celebrate, even when the future is murky. Even when we will become unsure of ourselves. Nevertheless, the gospel is present tense, and we are called to celebrate in the moment. There was a young man who discovered that he was critically ill and that he would die in the near future. And someone asked him, rather indelicately, whether he had a bucket list. And he answered, well, yes, I do. And then this friend said, well, you know, there's something on the internet, and you can find out what that bucket list is. And there are some people says, I want to eat a whole bowl of raw eggs. I want to climb the pyramids. I want to do everything. And his friend said, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I'm really too weak to do anything like that, but I have a better plan, and it's going to be enacted in the hospital. So his friend said, okay, and the fellow said, and you're invited too. So, on a weekend when there weren't as many medical personnel around, and he had very carefully, like Jesus, you know, Jesus orchestrates his movement into Jerusalem. He very carefully orchestrates the room he's staying in. He's asking if he can get a quieter room at the end of the hall, far away from the nurses and physician station. And then he invites a few of his friends, and they bring in something other than water and ice chips, and they begin to celebrate. They begin to dance. They begin to laugh. They begin to drink goblets of good wine. And a nurse comes in. And she looks at this scene. And the man who's rather young is dancing with his girlfriend in one arm, and he's dancing with that machine they have, which puts the drugs into your vein, you know, that you have to carry around. What is that called? A what? Yeah, that's what it's called. Just help me out with the sermon, will you? I'm not using any notes today, so just help me out. And, you know, I'm not getting any younger, so I may have just a kind of a senior moment where I can't recall a word I need to recall. So there he is, his girlfriend and this thing. And they're just kind of dancing together. They're dancing together. And the nurse comes in. And you know, she looks at it. She looks at it. She said, "My goodness, this is wonderful. They don't need me." And she leaves. And he calls out, "No, don't leave. Come in and join our celebration." So the mood gets serious for a moment. And they say, "You know, well, you know, what would you like to?" He was a Christian. He said, "What would you like to take with you? Is there anything you'd like to take with you?" And he said, "Apart from all your good wishes," he said, "I can't take my girlfriend with me because I hope she lives a long and prosperous life." He said, "I'd love to take my dog Tiggs with me, but I want Tiggs to live a long and industrious life. So what I'll take with me is this bright candy-colored swizzle stick. That will be what I'll take with me, because I know it's not only that I'm going to a better place, but I'm going to a place where Jesus says time and again, we're going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate our lives." And you know, that's skillful living. When we understand that the future and the near future may be murky, but we have enough faith in our good and gracious God to say that he wants us to celebrate in the moment. And indeed, he wants us to help other people celebrate in the moment. Oscar Wilde wasn't a Christian, but he was a good jokester. And even on his deathbed, he wanted his friends to celebrate the moment. So they're very serious and they're very sad. And he looks around them at his room and he says to his friends, "Either this wallpaper goes or I go." He wanted a joyful response, because I think in a way he knew that wasn't the end. So we are called then to celebrate life and to help other people celebrate life, even in the midst of our own pain, which is upcoming and impending. But again, I want to go further than simply celebration, because what Jesus shows us in our text is that if, as Hebrews says about Jesus, that he is human and in flesh like us in every way, the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 2, 14 through 18, that he is like us in every way. And therefore, he can be a faithful high priest to us because he understands who we are. And what we see in this text that I just read was really the full gamut of human emotions. And you know, we need to accept and understand who we are and how important a variety of emotions that we have truly are. Jesus tells his disciples to go and get that colt, that donkey, and bring it there. Now, was Jesus feeling self-confident? You bet. Was Jesus feeling on his game? Was Jesus feeling like a leader? You bet. Have you had those moments in your lives? You know, for whatever reason, you just kind of rise up and you get rid of your inferiority. You kind of think, "I'm just not a has-been, or I'm not just a factotum, but I'm a leader molded in the image of Jesus Christ, and I can do this." In fact, as Paul says a number of occasions, "Emulate me." Jesus says to his disciples, "Do this so that you emulate me in the power you have in leadership." You know, Jesus all wants us to be leaders. Jesus all wants us to help people understand what their lives are about. And then when we kind of skip the celebration, we've already said that Jesus wants us to be joyful. But Jesus also wants us to be sad, because that's part of our good humanity, which this text affirms that Jesus honors, and we should honor our sadness. You know, what I find is that God often puts me in places where I need to be, even though I don't know that at the time. And just a couple of days ago, I was dealing with a woman who's just has a heavy load to bear. I mean, just a really, really heavy load. And she said something very interesting. She said, "You know, I have to be strong for my family. I just have to be strong for my family. So I can't cry. I can't cry. I have to be strong." And I said, well, if that works for you, does that work for you? She said, I don't know. Sometimes it, I don't know. And I said, supposing your strength is nurtured by your tears. Supposing you need to do, and she had 100 things she had to do. She was dealing with multiple stressors. I said, supposing you have clarity, supposing you gain strength for what you need to do because you've spent time crying about a situation. That tears are God-given. That you can only be motivated when you feel the gamut and run of your hurt and pain and tragedy. You can only begin life again. You can only be resurrected when the tears flow unabashedly and unabatedly. So that becomes important. And when we look at the specifics of our text this morning, we realize what Jesus was crying about. That they would not accept him as the Messiah. And Jesus could look 40 years hence down the road and he could understand that his beautiful Jerusalem and the people he loved would be destroyed by the Roman armies under the future emperor Titus. And that makes me think too, when do we cry like Jesus? I think we cry when we understand that we can't fix a certain situation. You know? I mean, we're all good fixer-uppers, right? We're all good at helping people, all of us here. I mean, I'm not preaching to out there. For the most part, I know you, and I know what a special group you are. And I know that you spend your time trying to help people. And what happens often is we get frustrated at ourselves or we begin to doubt our own self-worth when we can't help every person who comes across our radar. You know, we think, what's wrong with me? I guess I just don't have faith enough or whatever. We look at Jesus, and he understood that he could not convert Jerusalem, and that Jerusalem would heedlessly go its way until it was destroyed completely in AD 70. So Jesus says, blessed are you who mourn, Matthew 5, for you will be comforted. And I think part of the comforting fact is to recognize the things we can change and to mourn the things we can't change. And to me, that's salvation. And finally, you know, Jesus was angry. Oh boy. Well, anger has no place in the Christian faith. Oh, anger is a dangerous emotion, we said. Well, it can be, right? And Paul has a number of different words in Ephesians for anger. You know, wrath, malice, this, that, and the other thing. It's like an Eskimo kind of parsing the different types of snow. Paul can talk about anger in all of its forms. But what we see here is an angry Jesus. I mean, that's the implication, isn't it? I mean, I don't think, do you, that Jesus goes into the temple, the court of the Gentiles, where they're making a hefty profit by changing one coin with the emperor, the image of the emperor, in another coin, the Syrian tetradrachma, which has no image, to pay their temple tax, which was high enough. And these money changers are getting a great interest for what they're doing. Jesus sees the injustice of that. And he goes right in and overturns the table. John tells us that he gets a cat of nine tails, a whip, and he starts whipping through. Now, I don't believe Jesus hated these people. I don't believe Jesus was enraged. But I believe that he was angry. I don't believe he came into that situation saying, oh, boys, oh, let's not do that. Hey, let's be nice and treat people fairly, shall we? Okay, let's do jumping jacks. 1, 2, 3, we'll be nice, okay? Because I'm nice, and I'm benign. I'm just a benign savior. So I want you to be nice, too. Will you all be nice? I can see them just ignoring him, but they couldn't ignore the guy who just upturns their tables and says, get out of here, because you've made my father's temple a den of robbers. You know, Jesus was angry. Can we accept our own anger? Can we accept that anger sometimes for us is motivating? That sometimes we need that prophetic anger, and Amos and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they all had it. Because God has given us an understanding of what is unjust. And sometimes we should cry in the midst of injustice, but sometimes we need to take action. And anger is a wonderful motivating factor. Now, Paul also says, be angry, but don't let the sun go down in your anger. Certainly. Certainly. But Jesus doesn't let the sun go down on his anger. He knows what he has to do. Anger is the propelling force. He does it, and then he's back to teaching the next day. So what does this passage tell us? It tells us to honor every emotion we have. They are all God-given. The text also tells us, I think, that don't be afraid when you start out confidently and end up perhaps not as confidently. Because we see Jesus in charge at the beginning, and at the end of the week we will see Jesus on the cross. And in Matthew and Mark saying, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? A cry of dereliction, a cry to the Father he loves, but nevertheless, something less than what we see on that Palm Sunday morning. Be assured that all your emotions are sanctified and experienced by Jesus Christ. You are human. Christ is human. Accept your humanity as you walk this week on his path. Thanks be to God for our victories in him. Thanks be to God for our full humanity. Thanks be to God for our strengths, which are embodied in our celebrative life, embodied in our tears, embodied in our anger. For God is God, and we are his faithful servants. Amen. Please greet one another this morning.